it's absolutely possible to see a church turned around. I really believe that to be the case. In fact, there's a church that's not very far away from where our headquarters are in Scotland. And about 4 years ago, the elders asked me to come and speak to them. So I went to see them. It was a church that maybe 30 years ago had been 200 strong and had now got down to about 35, mostly elderly people. And I knew the church very, very well. I knew these elders very, very well. And they said, well, what do we do? And I said, well, to be honest, the reason for the decline is you guys, apart from anything else. So you need to step aside. And there are people in your church who can take the thing forward. That wasn't an easy thing for them to listen to, but they know me very well. I know them very well. I met with them again a few months later. I said the same thing to them, and they agreed to do that. And it's only at the start of the process, but the new team took over about 6 months ago. And some folk couldn't handle the differences, so they left. So the 35 went down to about 25. They're now up to about 50. And they've seen their first couple of conversions. And I'm preaching there next week. And they're much more enthusiastic. And this is a church that thought they would close. They genuinely thought they would close. And now they're growing, they're optimistic, they sense God is with them, and they're really reaching out, genuinely reaching out. And that's a bit I want to think about today, because if churches are going to turn around, you have to get in contact with the local community, because churches grow by non-Christians joining us. Now, transfer growth can be a help. It can also be a hindrance, by the way. Transfer growth is not always a good thing. The best growth by far is for people who are unchurched, for people who are not Christians, to become Christians and to join the church. That's the best by far. And that becomes a challenge for us, because Christians are not always good at connecting with non-Christians. And the more our European culture disintegrates, and I don't know what countries you come from, but Scotland, where I live, is now one of the most secular parts of the UK. Our latest census came out. It was done in 2023, and the results just came out a month ago. And now the majority of Scottish people say they have no religious background at all. It's 51.8% of Scots now say they don't have any religious affiliation. And then when you turn to the religious groups, you have Catholics and nominal Protestants as the biggest two. Number three is Muslims, who are growing the fastest of all. And then evangelicals are a small proportion. So most folk in Scotland have no idea even where the churches are, or what they believe, or what Christians think. There's a huge distance culturally. And the only way to break down that and to get non-Christians to come to church is to get to know them and to become their friend. So I'm just going to throw out a few ideas that will at least get a conversation started. But I want to begin by saying that many Christians have a significant difficulty with their neighbor. First of all, because we have a wrong view of Scripture. Paul in 1 Corinthians 6 talks about, come out from amongst them and be separate. And I got saved in a very conservative church in the north of Ireland, where that verse was often quoted. And what they meant by that was, you know, when you come across people who aren't Christians, the great unwashed, have nothing to do with them. Don't go into their homes, don't talk to them, don't be nice to them. And yes, if they want to come to our gospel services, they're allowed to come to that, because they need to hear the gospel and they need to hear that they're going to hell. But apart from that, don't try to have any kind of relationship with them at all. That's not what Paul is saying. What Paul is saying is there's light and there's darkness. And we're part of the light. And we want to reach out to the darkness, but we don't get involved in the darkness. So come away from evil practices, wrong living, be holy. And by the way, holiness is essential if we really want to be witnessing to non-Christians, because they need to see the difference in our lives. So it's a wrong view of Scripture. It's also a wrong attitude towards non-Christians. Jesus talked about the two great commandments, love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Now, the love God bit evangelicals do very well, because we're devoted to God. But if your neighbor asks you for a favor, many of us say, oh, we're too busy. That's not how we reach lost people. They need to know that they are loved, that they are precious, and we'll think a bit more about that. Yeah, and then a wrong view of holiness as well. We think of holiness being a bit like you go off to a monastery in the just after the early church period, and we got past the patristics period. Monastic living became quite popular. Christians realized the world is a very lost and fallen place. And of course it was. The Roman Empire was horrendous. The immorality in the Roman Empire was horrendous, particularly amongst the elite. A bit like modern Europe today, actually. It's very similar. And so those folk who had a commitment to holiness would retire to monasteries and cut themselves off. And Jesus said, no, it's not like that. Your salt, your light, well, salt only stops infection if it's rubbed into the meat that is trying to stop from being infected. Light is only powerful if it's shining in the darkness. If this room, if we opened all the blinds and the sunshine was shining in here brightly, and you've got a really bright room because of the sunshine, and then you switch on the torch in your mobile phone, you won't see the effect of the torch because you're in the light. But if you're to go into the darkness, that's when you begin to see the effect of your torch. And that was the whole idea that Jesus was trying to communicate, that we are salt and we are light in the darkness, which means we need to be involved in people's lives and being friends with them. And when we do that, and we really get involved with them, that's when we begin to have a real impact. And actually, I'm very challenged just now because in Scotland, our most liberal political party is the party that's governing Scotland just now. They're extremely liberal with abhorrent policies. And they're, I don't know if you understand the term woke, but they're extremely woke as well as very left-wing. And the deputy leader of that party is an evangelical Christian. Now, she's hated by people in her party, many of them. She's hated because she's an open Christian. And she talks openly about her faith and the policy that she'd vote against, etc., etc. And she's also respected by many. But she's in what I think is one of the most sinister and difficult political parties in the whole country, with incredibly liberal policies, and they want to be in the very forefront of sexual liberation in all kinds of ways. And she's a Christian there, being salt and light in the darkness. Now, I greatly admire that. It takes great strength to do it, and I'll tell you some stories about my own situation, which some of you might find challenging, but the light shines when you're in the darkness. And so we need to get out there into the community. And finally, there's the issue of fear. We're just scared of non-Christians. What do we say to non-Christians? How do we relate to them? Not always easy. We often retreat behind the walls of our church because it's warm, it's comfortable, it's cozy with fellow believers. But out there in the cold world, it's tough, it's difficult. But that's where we need to meet. Now, I want to say something else that comes directly from the teachings of Jesus. Because when we talk about loving my neighbor, it begs the question, well, who is my neighbor? And one of the most interesting stories that Jesus told is from Luke chapter 10. And it's the story of the Good Samaritan. Now, that was a really interesting story and culturally quite a difficult one, because you'll know that the Jews hated the Samaritans so much so that Jesus and his disciples came from Nazareth in the north. And when they went down to Jerusalem for feast days and that kind of thing, the most direct route was to go right the way through Samaria. That's what you did. But of course, some of the Jews, conservative Jews, they despised the Samaritans. They would not even put a foot into Samaritan territory. So rather than going the direct route, they would take a wider route right the way around, which would add many, many, many hours to their journey. But it's better than actually walking through Samaria, which, of course, Jesus doesn't do. If you look at John 4, what does he do? Not only does he go through Samaria, but he sends his disciples off to find some food, and he sits by a well, and they come back to find Jesus again, and he's talking to a woman. Now, he shouldn't be talking to a Samaritan, because that's a pretty defiling thing to do. B, he shouldn't be talking to a woman. That's crossing another cultural boundary as well. And C, why is she there on her own? Normally, you'd go to the well in a group for protection. Why is she there on her own? Well, it's because she is so notorious with five broken relationships and now living with a guy who's not even her husband. And probably nobody in the village trusts her. The men don't trust her because they, you know, unless they are attracted to her sexually, they're not interested in her because she's the local loose woman. The women don't trust her because they're scared their husbands might find her attractive because she doesn't seem to have any sexual morals. So she has to go alone because nobody wants to associate with her. Even her own people don't want anything to do with her. And there's Jesus talking to her, breaking so many cultural taboos. And he actually reaches out to her and reading John 4, it's a brilliant, brilliant conversation starter if you want to learn about evangelism. It's a great way in which Jesus handled the situation and kept to the main focus. Doesn't matter where you worship God, the point is you need to worship God in spirit and in truth. It was a brilliant lesson in evangelism. Now, he tells the story of the Good Samaritan to illustrate that when we think about the people that we are to relate to, don't just remain within your tight-knit society. First of all, your church or the respectable, decent people that you know. But make sure that the neighbor you relate to is, well, people beyond your comfort zone. And my wife and I make a point of doing that. And it is beyond our comfort zone. It's not always easy. But if we want to reach out to people, we've got to go to places where we are uncomfortable. And by doing so, I'll reach out to them. So who is my neighbor? Well, it is, of course, the person next door. On one side of me, we've got an elderly couple who are very committed Roman Catholics. We have a great relationship with them. On the other side, we've got a couple. He's from a Chinese background. He's a kind of a lapsed Buddhist. His wife is Gypsy, but because she married a Chinese person, she was thrown out of the Gypsy community, so she's kind of a lapsed Catholic. They've both been in several relationships. Their family is spread across several relationships. And they're a very, very colorful couple. They're my neighbor. They're my neighbor. Also, people I'm in natural contact with. That might include people at work. I love sport. I began a football team. And the one rule I had in my football team is you can't be a Christian. Because I wasn't interested in having fellowship with Christians. I've got lots of fellowship with Christians. I wanted to meet non-Christians. So if you're a Christian, well, you can't join my football team. You have to be a pagan to do that. Because that's who I was willing to reach out to. And through sport, I've got natural contacts with people like that. It's also people that I can establish a rapport with. And by the way, Christians are, first of all, not always very good at being nice to the outsider. The smile is your greatest weapon in evangelism. Just smile at people. And they'll smile back and talk to them. People will more or less treat you the way you treat them. So if you're friendly with them, they'll be friendly with you. And secondly, Christians aren't very good at having deep relations with the people who aren't Christians. I have a friend of mine who's not a Christian. And he says to me, Christians are friendly, but they don't want to be your friend. Now, I think that's a very perceptive comment. But Jesus was the friend of sinners. That's how he was known. So anybody I can establish a rapport with, and if we think about it, we can establish a natural rapport with loads of people. They're all my neighbor, and they're the people I'm to love and to reach out to. So I'm going to say two things. First of all, I'm going to give you some ideas as to how we can begin to express love in general with all of those people who would be considered to be our neighbor. And then I want to hone in on what I think is one of the most important areas, and that is your own home and bringing people to your own home. Because for me, it's the very best environment in which we can do evangelism and share the love of Christ with people. How do I not just talk about loving my neighbor, but take practical action? And actually, it's not rocket science. It's really very, very simple. There's nothing complex about this. We just need to think about it and act. Think and then act. One way is just taking an interest in people. Now, my street, I'm in a cul-de-sac, which means it's a street that has no that ends with the houses. And to leave the street, you have to go out the same way you come in. It's not a very big street. We have 15 houses. We are number 15. So half on this side, the odd numbers, the even numbers this side. Only 15 houses in the street. And we moved to this house about 9 years ago, 10 years ago. And what we've just done is to get to know every family in the street. And somebody moved in just recently, and I saw her out painting her fence. It was one of the quite dilapidated houses in the street. So she's obviously trying to fix it up, a lady living on her own. I don't know what the situation is there yet. But I was driving past and I saw her painting her fence. So I stopped the car and I jumped out. And I said, "Hi, by the way, I'm in number 15. My name is Stephen. How are you?" And I held up my hand to shake her hand. And we had a conversation just over the fence as she was painting it. Just getting interested in people in your street. Who are they? What kids do they have? My wife notes all this stuff down because she's very good at that. I have a terrible memory and I'm not very good at writing things down either. But how many folk in your church know people in their street? It's remarkable how few. And when I'm doing evangelism stuff at my church, I ask people in my church, I want you to name all the people that you know personally in your street. Give me their names. And they might get to two names or three at the very most, and that's it. And they might have 100 people in their street. Just take an interest in people's lives. What's happening? Are your kids in school? What school do they go to? That kind of thing. It's just being friendly. Now, you're not going to throw the gospel at them right away. You just want to get to know them. And you can establish all kinds of contacts. And making sure you always talk to people when you have the opportunity. I have a small dog, and I go for a walk every day. My dog, Kelvin, is one of my greatest assets in evangelism. Why? Because loads of folk in our area have dogs. And so every time I come across a dog walker, I'll stop and say, "Nice to meet you. What's your dog called?" Because people like people taking an interest in their dog. So I've actually got to know people by the name of their dog. There's a guy down our street. He lives about 300 meters away from my house. And he's got a great big dog. It's a South African Ridgeback. And she's called Bella. And I patted Bella a few times walking past, et cetera, et cetera. And one day I said to him, "By the way, I know your dog's name. I don't know your name. Because I've just got to know Bella, and Bella knows my dog. But we've never actually talked. This is just 2 weeks ago." So I shook his hand, and we had a conversation, just 10 minutes, talking in the street. But it was a great conversation. Take every opportunity you can just to talk to people. I know all the folk in my local corner shop. And I also love food. I love kebabs. So my routine on a Sunday night, after I've been preaching in some church, wherever it is, I'll come back. I'll phone my wife and say, "Do you want something to eat?" I'll go to the kebab shop. They're all Muslims there. A third of my area is Muslim. And I'll order my kebab. And I'll chat to the guy. I know him in first name terms. And he's from Pakistan. And I did a mission trip to Pakistan years ago. So I said to him one day, "I'm going to bring in my photographs from Pakistan and show you." So I brought in my laptop with all these photographs on it. And I showed him dozens of pictures from Pakistan. We had a great conversation about Pakistan. It was a lot of fun. And I thought, how do I get the gospel in here? And two things happened which helped me get the gospel in. One was being a Muslim, he's got this Quranic text. Now, he's Pakistani, and the Quranic text will be in Arabic. So I said to him, "What does that say?" He said, "It's part of the Quran." I said, "Yeah, I know it's part of the Quran. Obviously it is, because you'll be a Muslim. But what does it actually say?" He said, "I don't know. I don't speak Arabic." Now, I would have known all this, but I played the idiot, and I said, "So you've got this holy book, and you can't actually read it?" "No." I said, "What language do you pray in?" And I knew what the answer was, but I just wanted to tease him out. He said, "Well, we pray in Arabic." I said, "So you speak Arabic, you don't speak Arabic, but you pray in Arabic?" "Yeah," he said, "God's language." I said, is that not strange? I said, does God understand Urdu?" And he'd never been asked that question before. So I said, "Actually, prayer is important in my life. I said, I just talk to God in my own language, in English, because God knows every language in the world." And I said, I grew up in Ethiopia. I love sometimes saying something in Ethiopian as well, because God knows that too. That's the wonderful thing about having a God that you have a personal relationship with. It was just a casual conversation, and I left it there. The next time, his wife was in, and she's very conservative, and she had her burqa on and all the rest of it. So I began chatting to her and asked her about her kids and all this kind of stuff. And I was just waiting for my kebab. And I said, you're obviously deeply religious and sincere because of the way you dress. I said, we're living here in Scotland. It's a really immoral country. I said, how do you feel about that? And she said, well, one of my worries is I don't want my children to become worldly. And I said, that's interesting. I said, a few months ago, I was in the Grand Central Mosque in Glasgow, and I was talking to the imam who lives up there, and he told me the same thing. And I said, you know what? I'm a Christian. We feel the same thing. I'm teaching my children good values, and I teach them to read the Bible and to pray and to love God. And I'm concerned when they go to school about the environment they're going to. Now, that was just waiting for a kebab. But it's just being friendly and talking and getting to know people and taking an interest. Then using special occasions. One thing we did last year, we've always given Christmas cards out to everybody in our street. And my wife, Debbie, said to me, why don't we actually invite our neighbors in for drinks? So when we took our Christmas cards round, we put in a little invitation, come around 7 o'clock for drinks and some snacks. Now, in Scotland, I don't know what your culture is like, in Scotland, that's a dangerous thing to do because people will bring their own drinks with them. It's called taking a takeaway with you. And Scotland has one of the worst alcohol and drugs problems anywhere in Europe. We have the greatest number of drug deaths in Europe. It's a heavy, heavy drinking culture. And we knew that to have folk in our home, they'll bring their own alcohol. I can't say to them, don't take that stuff. And we knew that some of them will get very, very, very drunk. That's just what they do. That's how Scottish culture works. Anyway, they came around, not all the street, but our house was full. And they all know we're Christians. And the Catholic lady next door, she's asking again, oh, are you doing any preaching these days? And of course, I do lots of preaching. So I was telling her about what I've been preaching over Christmas time with everybody else listening. It's a wonderful opportunity. The Buddhist guy said, see that whole thing in Israel? What do you think about that? And I expressed my concerns, et cetera, et cetera. He said, but Christians are the same. He said, look at the Crusades. I said, well, hang on a second. Let's talk about the Crusades. I said, first of all, we misunderstand the Crusades. But secondly, Jesus would never have approved. Jesus said, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who persecute you. And so I'm quoting scripture with everybody listening into this conversation. Now, folk had a few drinks in them, but that's okay. It was fantastic because I was able to share scripture. And I talked about Christian ethics in this, what was this, a Christmas event with the folk in our home. And then one of our other neighbors, his husband died. He was into martial arts, and so she got into Eastern mysticism and all this kind of thing. And my dog jumped up in her lap. But she loved dogs, and she put my dog's very old. She put her hands on my dog's shoulders and said, "Does your dog have arthritis?" I said, "Yes, he's just getting old." She said, "I'm a Reiki healer." She said, "I'm really a witch, but I can heal your dog." And so she proceeded to do this incantation while the dog's sitting on her lap and saying, "I'm going to pass energy over, and your dog's going to be healed." And then my Buddhist friend said, "I suffer from gout." He said, could you heal me? She said, of course I could. So he took his, I'm going to take my sandals off. He took his socks and shoes off and stuck his foot up in her knee. Now, by this stage, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And she put her hands on his feet and said, I'm going to heal your feet. And I said, here's an interesting thing. I said, Jason, I guarantee tomorrow your feet will still be sore. But Jesus is the great healer. And when Jesus healed people, whatever the disease, they stayed healed. So we had a conversation about that. Now, it was a kind of a chaotic situation with my house full of these. And one of my neighbors who is quite a religious lady, I'll tell you about her later on, quite a religious Catholic lady, as she was leaving, she said to Debbie and me, you guys live in the rough half of the street. Because she had never talked to these folk because they're all quite colorful characters. She'd never spoken to them, even though she lived in the same street as them for years. But it was great. just opening up our home. And then community events. In our community, we have a Facebook app that everybody goes on to. We exchange if we wanted to exchange furniture or sell stuff, or we've got bought too much rice or whatever. And if you want this, you know, here's the price I'm going to say. And we keep on that side and keep in touch and keep it going. And a couple of years ago, somebody said, why don't we have a barbecue in the waste ground? So Debbie and I said, great, we'll come and join you and we can help to cook. So it was a spontaneous community event with us being there with all these non-Christians. Local campaigns. There's a factory not far from us that it actually stinks. It's a chemical processing work that cleans up industrial refuse. But it smells terribly. And so some of the shopkeepers began a campaign. So we joined the campaign to get rid of the smell, and we're handing out leaflets to get focusing. We're interested in our neighborhood, our community. My daughter actually discovered, she's a teacher, she discovered a family in the area where she lives who had a child who was a boy, some educational difficulties. And so she said to the family, look, I know your son doesn't go to the school that she teaches at, but she said, I know your son has some difficulties. If you want, I can do you some tutoring for your son. And so she tutors this boy and has got to know the whole family through that. Just simple things. Responding to a crisis during COVID, this lady who's that religious lady I mentioned a few moments ago, her husband became very ill and he died during COVID. And she nursed him. It was so difficult for her. And we often saw the ambulances there because he needed some emergency care and stuff like that. But it was COVID and folk couldn't speak to each other. And I went one day and it was winter. I knocked her door and I said, look, you'll have your hands full caring for your husband. Can I go shopping for you? I'd like to bring you some stuff. So she said, oh, that would be really great. So she gave me a list of stuff that she needed because he was very ill by that stage. He died, but very ill by that stage. And I just went and got her some shopping. And so every periodically, I'd knock her door again. Do you want me to go shopping for you? And we got to know her just through offering to do that. And interestingly, once he died, she didn't like the funeral because it was very impersonal. In her Catholic church, it was very impersonal. And we were out for a walk with her dog and came back. And she's out in her garden. And we walked over to her and we said, how are you doing? Because her husband had been dead about 2 months by this stage. How are you doing? She said, oh, it's a struggle. And she began to cry. And I said, would you like us just to come in and chat to you for a few minutes? She said, oh, I'd love that. So I put the dog in our house. We came back to her house. We went in, sat around her table. She made us a cup of coffee. And we stayed for about an hour just talking to her and allowing her to unburden her grief. And then I said to her, would you like me to pray with you? Because her priest had never given her any real help. I said, would you like me to pray with you? She said, I'd love you to. So I prayed with her and prayed that God would help her in grief. And I read a verse to her. And as we got up to leave, she gave me a big hug. And she said, will you come back and pray with me again sometime? Now, just being friendly, that's all we did. And we now have a great relationship with her and it's great to link with her. And then just being there for people. I mentioned my daughter, but my neighbor next door, his oldest boy isn't actually his son. It's his wife's son, but not his son. It's from a previous relationship. And so he only stays sometimes with them, some weekends. And they have a very tempestuous relationship, even to the point where they've had physical fights in their back garden. And we hear the screams and the shouts and the foul language. And I knocked his door one day and I said to him, you've always had a fight with your boy. He said, yeah. He said, he's giving me cheek. And so I punched him. And I said, I know what it's like to have a son who's caused me heartache. I said, I've been praying for your son. I said, do you want me to pray with you now? He said, okay. And I prayed for his son. And a lovely end of that story is he noticed in my window a chess. I don't actually play chess. It was from my wife's late father's house. He was a chess player, but he died. And I said to Debbie, it looks nice, beautiful chess. So let's take it home. And my neighbor said to me, do you play chess? I said, no, I don't. He said, oh, I love chess. I said, well, will you teach me? He said, no problem, let me know when. I said, how about Friday night? So he turned up Friday night with his bottle of wine, of course, which he does. And I said, bring your wife and she and Debbie can watch a movie together. So the two of them were in our house from about 8 o'clock at night to about 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Wonderful time. And the conversations we had about faith were just immense. And so we played chess. And he's become a really close neighbor. When I go away traveling, he'll text me to say, I see you're away because my car's missing. He said, I'll put out your bin for you. It's bin day on Friday. And he just does that spontaneously because he wants to be a friend. Now, I want to get to the last bit, and then we're going to finish. Opening up your home. Opening up my home. The Bible is full of talk about hospitality. In the Old Testament, if you didn't give hospitality to people, you were judged for it. And think of Jesus. Imagine Mary and Martha and Lazarus. How big a house did they have? Probably not very big. And suddenly Jesus turns up plus 12. It's a lot of people to feed. But it's what they did. The early church hospitality was a big part of their work. Now, hospitality can be various. I've stayed in all kinds. I travel widely. I've stayed in Christian homes in probably 40, 45 different countries. I've had some good experience of hospitality. I've had some embarrassing experiences of hospitality. I was in one home. Now, only one of the people in that home was a Christian. But they offered me a bed for the night. And I went there. And they were cat-obsessed. The house smelled of cats. And I don't like cats anyway. And I'm allergic to them. But they were an unusual family, to say the least, where a cat jumped up on the table during dinner and began eating off the plates. So when I came over to my plate, I stabbed it with my fork, hoping that my host wouldn't see that. I stayed in some unpleasant places. I also stayed in some very wealthy homes where people have been just showing off their splendor and their wealth. And I felt very uncomfortable there. I've also been massively at home. Staying with people, massively at home. I've slept in some floors in people's homes because they don't have a bed to give me. But the warmth of the welcome. And I've stayed with millionaires where I felt relaxed because the warmth of their welcome is just tremendous. There's one house I've stayed in up in the Shetland Islands, very, very wealthy family, who decided that they weren't going to put a lock on their front door. They built a house, a big palace. There's no lock on it. And they said to me, if you're ever here and you need a bed for the night because you're preaching in a local church and we're away on holiday, just use the house. Help yourself. Wonderfully welcoming. A smile and a welcome is the key thing. But there are reasons why we don't want folk in our house. We can be too guarded. I don't want folk to see how I live. I don't want folk to see how my kids behave. I don't want people to see what I watch on television. Or maybe we're too lazy. It's a lot of work having folk. We often have groups of people around after church on a Sunday. And the work and the expense to go shopping, to buy food for half a dozen people, to prepare a nice meal, to clear up afterwards, and they're there all day. It's a lot of work. We probably spend more money on food for visitors than we do on ourselves, because we have folk in the home all the time. But it's a great thing. A book that changed my life was Rosario Butterfield, The Gospel Comes with a House Key. I would recommend that book to you. Get it on however you can get Christian books. The Gospel Comes with a House Key by Rosario Butterfield. She was a lady who's a radical feminist and a professor and in a same-sex relationship. And very anti-Christian. She got invited to this very conservative reformed pastor's house for a meal because he was a neighbor. And she said in her book, I only went there because I needed to see what my enemy believes. And he just loved her. And through him and frequently offering her hospitality, she became a Christian. And she's now married with family. And she commits her life to hospitality. It's a fantastic book. Every church should have a copy. There are barriers to that. And when folk do come to your home, particularly non-Christians, read the room carefully. Because they're in your private space, and therefore they could feel very vulnerable unless you listen and observe and mold the conversation to them. I don't want anybody to feel uncomfortable in my home, no matter who they are, how sinful they are. And we're all sinful, let's face it. How sinful they are, how broken their lives are. I don't want anybody to feel uncomfortable. So read the room carefully. Never forget the power of a smile. People love a smile. Just be warm. Just be friendly. Just be encouraging. And there are challenges to having an open home. It affects your family life. Our first home that we had was very, very small. So when we had people in the house and we were talking about very deep and personal things, our kids knew to go upstairs to their rooms. And they spent many hours in their room because we were downstairs dealing with people and talking about it. It does affect your family life. Also, we've had some real characters in our house, real characters. And my kids know what kind of people they are. And we've brought our kids up in that kind of environment. Their eyes have really been opened to some of the mess of people that we've dealt with. It is a challenge, and it's expensive, and it's time-consuming. But, you know, I preach probably about 100 times a year, and I keep saying to my wife, although I do loads of preaching, the most important thing we do is have folk in our home. It's the most important thing, whether they're Christians or non-Christians, just opening up our home to them. And there are a number of key principles which I think are hugely important. Let me just read out my list of key principles, because I think these are, for us, my wife and I have learned through the school of hard knocks that these principles are really important when you have people in your home. Number one, respect the reality of your neighbor's life and household. Respect the reality of your neighbor's life and household. My neighbors who I talked about who come from broken relationships and dysfunctionality and they both drink alcohol excessively. He's gone through phases of taking dope as well. But they're lovely people. Now, if you open up your home and you really want to be serious about reaching non-Christians, don't expect everybody who walks in to be a nice, sorted, pleasant, respectable person. That's not going to happen. Doesn't make them bad. Respect the reality of their house and the complexity of their situation. We've had folk in our home who are in a same-sex relationship. They're in a committed, loving relationship, but it's same-sex. Now, what are we going to do? How are we going to treat them? Respect the reality of the situation where they're at. That's where discipleship comes in. If these folk do become Christians, there's a lifelong process of discipleship. Number two, pray that you'll be a safe person to hear the burden of your neighbor's heart. Pray that you'll be a safe person. They'll have enough confidence in you to tell you their deepest hurts. I have had the most incredible things being confessed and talked about in my home. The most incredible. From people's, the depth of people's brokenness and hurts. And they shared it with us. I think it's a privilege. So we pray that we'll have enough warmth as we reach out to them, that they'll have the confidence to tell us anything, absolutely anything, and they do. Number three, there are only five in total. Differentiate between holiness and goodness and celebrate goodness. My neighbor, several of my neighbors are not holy at all. They are not holy, but they're good people. They're kind. They're generous. They love their kids. Okay, their families are very dysfunctional, but they love their kids. They're decent people. They're helpful neighbors. They're good people to have. I trust them. Now, they're not holy. They're far from holy. But they're good people. And I affirm the good things that I see in them. Christians can often be so judgmental. There's a lot of good in people that we often look past because they might be living in a sinful sexual relationship, for example. Celebrate the goodness. Number four, don't question the motives of a different perspective. Now, question and challenge some ideas. And I do challenge people on their ideas. I do challenge some of the things that they do. I get a neighbor who deals in stolen goods. And he's tried to give me stuff before. I've got another neighbor who's a river warden. He confiscates fish that's been fished illegally, salmon fish illegally, he confiscates that from the poachers. And if they've been illegally shooting wild birds, he confiscates the bird they shot for meat. And his freezer's full of them. It's interesting. And when I've had meals with him, I've enjoyed his fare as well. I often challenge what people are doing. I don't challenge their motives. Because sometimes people do the wrong thing, but maybe their reason behind it could be okay. So I don't want to undermine them as people, even if I challenge the sin in their lives. And number five, be holy, not pious. Debbie and I want to live holy lives, and we need to live holy lives because the only way that our light can shine is if we are living holy lives. But I don't want to be pious. I don't want my neighbors to think I think I'm better than them because I'm a sinner too. Now, yes, we're trying to live holy lives, but I don't want them to think that in any way I judge them. And when I bring up the issue of God's forgiveness, I say, look, the thing I love about being a Christian is God has forgiven me for all the wrong in my life. I've done wrong stuff, and he's forgiven me. And I'm just so grateful for that. That's how I share the issue of sin with them. I talk about how I've been forgiven. So I want to live a holy life, but I don't want to be pious. And then there are the practical issues. And with this, I will finish, I promise. The practical issues. What do you do with, for example, over a meal saying grace? If somebody has never said grace before or never been in that position, sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But if I ever do, I say to the folk, do you mind if we give God thanks for food? Because that's what we do as Christians. Yeah, go ahead. And I've found myself going out for a meal with non-Christians who've got to know me, and they've said, do you want to say your prayer before we start eating? In a restaurant. And it's been great. So think about that. What do I do about grace? What do I do about alcohol? Now, in Scotland is an alcohol-drenched culture. Every social event is full of alcohol. Now, my wife and I do drink alcohol, obviously in moderation. And when we're in other people's homes or when they're in our home, people will normally bring alcohol with them. That's the culture. And my wife and I will have a glass of wine or we'll have a beer, and then we stop at that. And by the way, my neighbors notice that we stop at that. It's become obvious to them that we stop at that. And I've had some neighbors even apologizing that they've maybe been a wee bit too lavish with, and I said, look, guys, it's fine. You know my stance, but I don't get drunk because that's not how God wants me to live my life. And I'm very open about why I don't get drunk. What do you do about bad language? I mean, Scottish folk often have bad language, and the gypsy community, they swear like it's a pastime. So I've had people in my house using foul language. What do you do in a situation like that? We have a policy. I'll let it go unless they are using vicious criticism or vicious language about somebody else, either in the room or somebody else that we know. And I'll say, guys, do you mind not being so critical of that person? I don't think it's healthy. And speaking about the person that way, that's not fair. So please stop it. So if it's directed to somebody, a person that we know, I will challenge that. But if it's just people who swear because they swear, I don't worry too much about that. Now, people will take a different stance, but I don't worry too much about that. And then what do you challenge? I do challenge people in my home, but I'm careful what I challenge them on. And I tend to say, don't speak like that. I did so in football. When I had my football team, I got injured, so I had to stop. But when I had my football team, the guys would swear a lot. That's okay. If they became abusive towards each other, I'd stop the game and say, guys, I'm not having anybody being abusive towards another player. So just cut it out now or you can't play. And I did challenge that all the time. So they were never allowed to shout at each other, never. I'd put them off the pitch for shouting at each other. I just wouldn't permit that. So I do take a stand and challenge things, but it depends on the context. So be aware of what you will or what you won't challenge. So those are just a few practical things. Opening up your home is a difficult thing. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. It is difficult, but it's fruitful. And you know one of the best things I've found? invite a non-Christian friend, a couple or a family, to your house for a meal, and invite somebody from your church who's a Christian to come and have a meal. Because you're doing training in evangelism and evangelism yourself all at the same time. That's a great thing to do.